closing out our attribute study, and I had the opportunity to teach in that on the sixth week, the last week. And at that point, we were really just almost a year ago. We were about a year out, or a couple weeks out from an accident that my son was in on March 3rd. So coming up on Sunday will be the 1 year anniversary of when our son was in this really significant car accident. And so I had spent was spending quite a bit of time in Fort Wayne with him. I was back here to teach and share with you guys about that. A lot of people have been so kind to ask how he's doing. So I thought I would take the chance and just let you know that Alex is definitely recovering. He still lives in Fort Wayne. He has an apartment with his roommate from college and a full-time job and is really continuing to recover very well. But back in December, he had some surgery on his knee to remove some hardware that was giving him some pain that had been put in there to help him, you know, get his stability back. But in any case, after that surgery, we were talking to the doctor about, you know, what can we expect for recovery? And as I was preparing for this study, I remembered what the doctor said. It was really interesting. You know, he's like, Alex, you know, you have to recognize you are never going back to the way you were. You know, you have a titanium femur. That's going to be with you for the rest of your life. You're never going back. But you can go forward. You know, you can keep working on recovery. You can regain flexibility and, you know, strengthen your muscles. You're going to be able to do a lot of the things you used to do and maybe even some new things that you've never done before. But you can't just sit around and wait to go back to the way you were. It's just not going to happen. You got to go forward into a new healthy place. And then when I was thinking about Joseph and where we are in our study right now, that's kind of where Joseph was. You can imagine when he was a slave and when he was a prisoner, he would long for the time when he could just go back to Canaan, back to who I was before and forget that all of this horrible thing has happened to me. But as we move now finishing Genesis 41, moving into Genesis 42, what we're going to see is that there is really going to be no going back for Joseph. He's never again going to be that, you know, Hebrew herder that he was before. He's going to have to go forward into where God is leading him now. He is moving into definitely a brand new season of life. And really, he's going to have some new opportunities to be really, in my opinion, far more fruitful than he would have ever imagined being, you know, out in the fields with the sheep. He's going to be doing things that are on a far grander scale than anything he probably imagined for his life. So let's move into the end of Genesis 41 today. And our lesson number one as we close out that chapter is that God is faithful. And so this is going to be our theme for today, that God is faithful during every season of life. And our challenge then for us is to remember his gracious provision. And we're going to be seeing this over and over, that God is teaching, we're going to learn some lessons in grace, and we're going to see that God is faithful. So let's open up our Bibles today as you finish writing down your point there. We're going to look at Genesis 41, and we're picking up in verse 37. Joseph is now 30 years old, and we've seen that the past 13 years of his life have been characterized by really one unexpected event after another. And he's experienced things that are totally out of his control and definitely not of his choosing. So this is not what he would have wanted. He has gone through a lot of difficulty and testing, but over and over we've seen that God is with Joseph. God has been faithful to him and has really provided everything Joseph needs, and that's what we're going to see as we enter this new season with Joseph. So there in Genesis 41, verse 37, it says, "This proposal pleased Pharaoh and all of his servants." So we're right in the middle of a thought here, aren't we? So the question would be, like, what proposal are we talking about? And so let's think back to last week. If you remember, Pharaoh had two dreams. He knew that they were very significant in some way, but no one could tell him what these dreams mean. And then finally, the cupbearer was like, oh, yeah, I remember. You know, a few years ago, you were really mad at me. You sent me to prison. There was someone there who interpreted dreams. And so Pharaoh then had Joseph brought up out of prison and cleaned him all up. And Pharaoh brought Joseph in, and he did interpret these dreams that he had had. And Joseph said, you know, there's going to be 7 years of plenty, followed by 7 years of famine. And then not only did Joseph give the interpretation, he also suggested a plan for how they could survive the years of famine by taking advantage of the years of abundance. And so this is what had pleased Joseph, or I'm sorry, what had pleased Pharaoh. As we go on, then, Pharaoh says to his servants, can we find a man like this in whom is the Spirit of God? So if you remember, Joseph had repeated that it's God who will give the interpretation. It is God who will bring this to pass. And so Pharaoh has rightly concluded, we need a man in whom is the Spirit of God. So if God's going to do this, we need someone who, you know, who knows this God. And so Pharaoh says, we need a man on whom is the Spirit of God. But then very quickly, he doesn't really wait around for anyone else to step up. He says to Joseph, since God has shown you all of this, there is none so wise and discerning as you are. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only in regards to the throne will I be greater than you. And then he says, see, Joseph, I have set you over all the land of Egypt. And just like that, like in a snap of a finger, Joseph has gone from a slave and a prisoner to second in command of all of Egypt. A massive improvement, right? Like this is like definitely so much better than his former situation. But notice that he's really, again, not given any choice about what he's going to do. It's just a Pharaoh saying, hey, God told you this, and you're going to carry it out. You don't hear Pharaoh saying like, oh, Joseph, you'd be perfect. What can we do to give you this job? Or he doesn't say, Joseph, I'm going to give you your freedom. Whatever you want, it's yours. This is a royal command. You're going to do this thing. And we can also, you know, probably understand based upon, you know, what we know about a royal culture there in Egypt, that if things don't go well in this, you can take the responsibility as well. So Joseph now has this massive responsibility given to him. But remember, he has been well prepared for what God is going to call him to do here. If you think back, he had been as a slave. He had been the overseer of Potiphar's house and all of his estate. And then in prison, once again, he had been put in charge, kind of the overseer of all the prisoners. And so here he is now as the prime minister of Egypt, but everything in his life has prepared him for this moment. So to kind of finish the transition from Hebrew slave to Egyptian royal court, we'll see that Pharaoh does a number of things in the next verses there. He takes off his signet ring and he gives it to Joseph and puts that on Joseph's finger. So this is what royal seal that he will use to authenticate all of the commands he will make to the people of Egypt. And then Pharaoh dressed him up like an Egyptian in that fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. And then he took him out on parade. And so Pharaoh would ride in the first chariot, and Joseph rode in the second chariot, and they commanded all the people of Egypt, you now bow the knee to Joseph. And then Joseph was given a new Egyptian name. He was called Zaphnath-Paneah, and he was given a royal Egyptian wife. Who was the daughter of a priest. And so now you see Joseph, you know, wearing the Pharaoh's signet ring, dressed like an Egyptian, Egyptian name, Egyptian wife. He has entered an absolutely new season of life. And as with each of the experiences he's had in the past, you know, we can know, we're going to see that God will be faithful. God will continue to be with Joseph. You know, our seasons of life change a lot, don't they? We go through many different stages of life. And as I was thinking about this, I remember back to the first really new season of life. I remember, for me, it was when I went to kindergarten. And I did not want to go to kindergarten. I wanted to stay at home with my mom and my two little brothers. That felt good. That was comfortable. Kindergarten seemed scary. But that is not how life is, right? We don't get to stay where we were. We have to keep moving through the seasons of life. That's when growth and change happens. You know, everything in nature tells us that when the seasons change, that's when, you know, everything is renewed and when everything grows and changes. You know, most recently for me, as I think forward then all of these years now, back in August, I feel like my life really went through a change as well. And I know some of you might identify with this one. In August, my oldest son turned 25. So that seemed like a big milestone. I'm sure it was in his life, and it was to me. And then a little bit after that, we helped Alex, our middle son, move out for good. He had come home for the summer to just recuperate and to recover some health. But in August, he moved out, and I know he's really never coming back. the same way. And then really quick after that, in August, our youngest son went back to college for the second year, and this time he didn't even need our help. You know, he just threw all of his own stuff in the car and drove himself back. And I thought, you know, my years of like being a mom every single day, like day-to-day mothering, is kind of over. And there's a lot of emotions that come about as we move from one thing to the next, whether it be sadness or fear, but sometimes excitement and anticipation. You know, there's just emotions attached to changing, whether it be whatever that change looks like in your life, whether it be a graduation or a new job or a new house or getting married or being divorced, having a child, losing a parent. You know, just think as we go through life, seasons do change. But all of these give us opportunity to grow and to experience the things that God wants us to do. As we can see that God is faithful, just like we've seen that with Joseph, we can see it in our own lives as well. And to know that God will graciously give us what we need for each new season of life. In the next verses in Genesis 41, we see a couple of things that Joseph did and some things that we can learn about growing in a new season of life. And so there's three things that we're going to talk about here as we go into a new season, whatever that might be for you. In verse 46 is the first one, and I'll say in this, what I'll call this, is embracing the opportunities that you have right where you are. So, you know, you might move from one season to the next, but there's going to be new things to do. So embrace those opportunities. In verse 46, it says that Joseph then went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went through all the land of Egypt. So if we remember back to who Joseph was before he was a herder. He would go out into the wilderness, up into the mountains, sometimes hiking out, you know, 30, 40, 50 miles to take care of the flocks and the herds. So he would have loved that ability to roam and to wander. And as a slave or a prisoner, he didn't get to do that. But now, in this new time of his life, he can't really go back to Canaan and see his old home, but he can see everything there is to see in Egypt. And you can just imagine him going from one end of Egypt to the other. You know, he wanted to see everything there was to see in this new land. Even though he can't go back, he can move forward into new opportunities. And so as your, you know, seasons of life change, you know, let's not long for what we used to do, but really just embrace, you know, what you have right now. And a second one that we see in Joseph as well is this using just the gifts and abilities that God has given you. As we go on in these next verses, we see that Joseph had been prepared. He had the ability to do what God was calling him to do right now, and he was really, really busy. I mean, and you kind of get that as you read about him gathering the harvest, going from city to city, measuring it, storing it. Eventually, there's so much grain, they don't even measure how much they have. And then, though, if you fast forward to verse 55, it talks about the years of famine. And they didn't just sit around in the years of famine. That's when they had to, you know, dole out the grain. And it says in verse 55, Pharaoh said to the Egyptians, "Go to Joseph, what he says to you, do." So when the famine had spread over the land, Joseph opened the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, and all the earth came to Egypt, to Joseph, to buy grain, because the famine was severe in all of the earth. So in both cases, throughout these 14 years, Joseph was very busy using those skills and abilities that God had perfected in him over the course of his life. So God had prospered him in each season. He had gained wisdom, and he had perfected his natural abilities. I mean, like Joseph, God gives us things to do, whatever part of life you're in. I mean, Ephesians chapter 2, it says that we were created for good works, which God has prepared for us in advance. So everywhere that you are, God has prepared something in advance for you to do. And so we need to be willing to embrace that opportunity and then use those abilities that God has given you as he has prepared you over the course in your life. And then a second one, or a third thing too, then we'll see that Joseph recognized God's presence and his gracious provision at every point in life. So for now, Joseph has really left most of his Hebrew identity behind. But we'll see in these verses that God has not been left behind. So he now looks very Egyptian. He has an Egyptian wife. He's very much part of the Egyptian culture, but he hasn't left his God behind. He hasn't blamed God at any point for all the trouble that he's had. And in verses 51 and 52, we're going to see that Joseph has two children during those 7 years of plenty. So he gave his sons, what I think is interesting, even though he has an Egyptian name now, he's given his sons Hebrew names. And they're very significant Hebrew names that say kind of a recognition of what God is doing in his life. So in verse 51, it says, Joseph called the name of his firstborn Manasseh, for God has made me forget all my hardships and all my father's house. So he named his first son essentially Forget. Forgetful, and that word forget in this verse, it means to fail to hold in mind. So what he's saying here is that God has enabled me to move beyond the hurt and the hardship in my past. I'm no longer actively thinking about these things and holding them in my mind, I'm not holding on to the sins that were committed against me. In Psalm 103, we read that this is how God treats us. It says that God does not deal with us according to our sins, but as far as the east is from the west, so far does he remove our sins and iniquities from us. And really, this is our example of how we want to deal with the past sins and the hurts and the hardships that we've had. And we don't want to keep holding these things in our mind. We don't want to deal with others according to their sin, but rather we want to let God help us move beyond and help us forget. This doesn't mean that what happened didn't happen. And we don't deny the hurts that you've experienced really do, that shapes us, and in many cases shapes us in ways that we'll never go back to before. But yet we don't have to be constantly thinking about what happened in the past, about the hurt and the failure, or even our own sins. God doesn't want us to stay in that place, because when we stay there, then we continue to be identified by those things. And we don't want to be always thinking of ourselves as betrayed and wounded and hurt, or liar, or unforgiven. Like, these are not the words we want to use to identify ourselves. We want to move beyond that hurt and hardship and move into the identity that Christ wants us to have. So God will help us then to take on the identity of child of God, beloved, forgiven, and redeemed. We want to not hold in mind the hurt of the past and let God move us beyond, recognizing that God doesn't deal with me according to my sins, and I am not going to deal with others according to my sins. I'm going to extend the grace God has given me to those around me. So that was his first son, Forgetful. The second son that he had, in verse 52, it says, he called his second son Ephraim, for God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. So Joseph is saying, you know, Egypt is no longer called land of my affliction. It's now land of my fruitfulness. And really, this does reinforce the idea that God prospered Joseph in every stage of life. But it's not just that I was fruitful, I'm prosperous. It's that God has made it happen. Over and over, we see Joseph saying that God is faithful, that God will provide, that God will give the interpretation. You know, it's so easy for us to blame God for the hard things that happen and then really take the glory and all the joy for the good things that happen. And so we need to learn from Joseph's example here. Recognize God's faithful provision and his graciousness to us when things are hard and when there's times of difficulty, and also in prosperity. And as we do this, then really, that's when God's goodness begins to fill our hearts in every season of life. And so that brings us really to the end of chapter 41. And as we move into chapter 42, we're going to kind of turn a little bit of a corner and focus now again on Joseph's family, on his brothers. Some of you might remember, if you were in my case when I was a kid, I watched a show called The A-Team, and I think there's a new A-Team out now. I don't remember that one. But when I was a kid, that show was something that we watched, and there was a character who would say, "I love it when a plan comes together." And that's kind of what we're going to see here. God has been working, and we've been saying this all along. God has a plan. He is working. He's working all things for good. But we've just had to believe it. And now we're going to see God is in control, and the plan is starting to come together in chapter 42. So lesson number two for us then is that God is faithful and he will help you extend grace rather than exacting justice. So now if we think about where we are in this narrative, all of Egypt and all of the world is coming to Joseph to buy grain because the famine is severe in all the earth. Now, in Psalm 105, we've talked about this psalm in the past, is a poetic history of God's faithfulness to the people of Israel. And verses 16 and 17 in Psalm 105 talk about this, what we're studying right here. And in those verses, we see, first of all, that God, it says that God summoned the famine on the land and broke the supply of bread. So God brought this famine to Egypt, and we've seen how God revealed what was going to happen. God caused the famine to happen, and we know that God sent Joseph ahead to Egypt. So God was orchestrating these events to set up exactly what he wanted to have, because God wanted to move the family of Jacob from Canaan over to Egypt for a season of time. And God had promised this. He had said, I'm going to work in your family. There's going to be a season that you are going to spend in Egypt. And remember that growth and change happens in a season of change, right? And so we're going to see that in the life of Israel, if you were to read forward, that God used their time in Egypt, and he is starting it right here. He has ordained worldwide events to bring Joseph's family and Jacob's family right where he wants them to be. So let's read a little bit here in chapter 42 in verses 1 to 4, first 5 verses. It says, when Jacob learned that there was grain for sale in Egypt, he said to his sons, why do you look at one another? And he said, behold, I have heard there is grain for sale in Egypt. Go down and buy grain for us there that we may live and not die. So 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. But Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brothers, with his brothers, for he feared that harm might happen to him. And thus the sons of Israel came among the others who came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. So at this point, we are probably a year at least into the famine, because you know they had the 7 years of plenty, at least a year where the crops probably didn't produce, and so there's probably at least a year into the famine. So we probably imagine that Joseph is now 38, 39 years old when his brothers come into Egypt and come before him to buy grain. In verse 6 and 7, it says that Joseph's brothers came and they bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. And Joseph recognized his brothers, but he treated them like strangers and he spoke roughly to them. Now, we don't really know why that Joseph responded this way. It might seem natural to us, like he saw them, he knew them. He'd be like, hey, I'm Joseph, your little brother. But we know that God has really guided Joseph at every step of the way. And for whatever reason, and as we'll see here going forward, God had a plan that was going to look a little different than that. And so Joseph then starts to question them in this rough manner. And he's like, where are you from? And they say, we're from Canaan. We're here to buy food. And then at this point it says in verse 9 that Joseph remembered his dreams. And I think that's interesting. So he saw them, he recognized them, he starts questioning them, and then all of a sudden he remembers his dreams. Because now what we just read in chapter right before said he wasn't actively thinking about all these things all the time, right? He had moved beyond that a little bit. But in this moment, all of a sudden, he's beginning to see God has a plan and it's all starting to come together for him. So he continues then with this line of questioning. He's like, no, you're not here to buy grain, you're spies. And then they're like, no, we're not here to buy, you know, we're not here as spies. We're honest men. So it's interesting. He said to them kind of, you know, you really just want to see how weak we are. You don't want to buy food. And they're like, no, we're honest men. We're the sons of one man. We have never been spies. And it's interesting to think about the fact that of all the people they could say this to, Joseph knows for sure they're really not honest men. As a matter of fact, he's pretty sure, and he knows by experience, they've been cruel and calculating and often really evil in the way they've treated not just him, but other people as well. And so you can see here, Joseph now is sort of starting to probe in. He wants to see what is the real intent, what is actually going on here. So they attempt to prove their honesty by offering now even more information. And they say, we're 12 brothers. One is no more. One is back in Canaan with our father. And we 10 are here to get grain for our families. Ironically, the one who is no more is the very one that they're talking to. And the one back in Canaan then was Benjamin, Joseph's brother. And you can only imagine then how he would have longed to know, like, what is going on with Benjamin? Have they been as evil and mean to Benjamin as they were to me? And so you can see that he really just wants to get to the truth of what's going on with his family. And so Joseph now offers them an opportunity to prove that they are not spies. In verses 15 through 17, it says, "By this you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not go from this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you and let him bring your brother while you remain confined, that your words may be tested whether the truth is in you. Or else by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies." And so Joseph would have probably had felt some responsibility to actually determine what they were here for. And so he's wanting to get at the truth of what are you here for? And then also you hear in his words as well, "And I really just want to see my younger brother." Because too, if you remember back to his dream, so he's thinking about all this. In his dreams, there were 11 sheaves of grain that bowed down to him. And right now there's only the 10 brothers here. So he knows God has brought them here, but it's not yet a full fulfillment of the dreams that I had had. And so you all send someone to get Benjamin and come back here. And then put them in prison for 3 days for some reason. And I don't really know what happened in those 3 days, but it seems to be a little bit of a change of heart. Because Joseph calls them out of prison 3 days later, and he gave them really what I would call now a little bit more gracious opportunity to prove their honesty. In verse 18, it says, "Do this and you will live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers remain confined where you are here in custody, and let the rest of you go and carry grain for the famine for your households, and bring your youngest brother to me, so your words will be verified and you will not die." And they agreed to this because, let's be honest, they really did not have any choice at this point. And so in this situation now, Joseph has all the power. In the same way that he was absolutely at their mercy 20 years ago, they and really the entire family are now at his mercy. Their survival depends on him. And thankfully, as he has just revealed, he fears God. He is ruled by a desire to be worshipful to God, to keep himself under the authority of God. Joseph is probably at this point the second most powerful man in all of the earth, and yet, thankfully for his family, he views the authority of God as over his authority. Proverbs 9:10 tells us that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. And so understanding a situation or having wisdom as to how we'll respond really comes as we have that fear of God or that desire to worship God in our hearts, keeping ourselves under submission to his authority. In this situation, Joseph had this opportunity now to take matters into his own hands and really right the wrongs that had been done to him. And if you think of it, that's what his brothers did. When they were in power, when they didn't like how things were going, they took control and they sold Joseph, and that's how he ended up in Egypt. But we see Joseph responding in the opposite way, right? He has established a pattern in his life of putting himself under God's authority, of acknowledging that God is holy. I will not sin against God, and resisting temptation and recognizing that God is at work and God will be the one that will do what needs to be done in this situation. And so all of these things over the course of his life are what prepared him for this situation, right? As he got here and makes the right choice, it's because he has been consistently making right choices throughout the course of his life. He has lived under God's authority. And so now, in this moment, and I'd have to say, this might be probably the most, in my opinion, the biggest temptation that he's had thus far, because he has the absolute power to do whatever he wants. And nobody really is going to question him. Remember, all of Egypt operates under his authority, so he can do whatever he wants, and yet he puts himself under God's authority. Very few of us will ever face this kind of power and this situation of this magnitude, but we do all have opportunities in various situations to extend grace to those that hurt us, or to hold on to the feeling of power that we get as we try to exact our own kind of justice, or to manipulate a situation so that it feels better for us. And so these principles that we see in Joseph's life really apply to our lives as well, in the big hurts, in the really hard things, and in the everyday things as well. Because every day we have, you know, someone who lets us down or speaks harsh words or doesn't really meet the expectations that we have. But rather than letting those hurts and wrongdoings that others do to us and be the focus of our lives, rather than thinking about those things and dwelling on them, let's remember what Joseph has done here. He's been aware of God's presence in his life all along. He has let God move him beyond the hurt and hardship and into a new and fruitful place. He acknowledges God's graciousness to him. And by seeing himself as a recipient of grace, then when he has this opportunity now, he's been able to overflow grace into the life of others. A couple of weeks ago, Christy talked with us about imagining yourself as either a potato or an egg. Remember that? We talked about how the water of life gets boiling, and you're going to be changed by that, one way or the other. You've got to decide, are you going to let God soften my heart and change me in good ways, or am I going to be like an egg that gets hard and brittle in boiling water? And so you're going to be changed one way or the other. But I would also encourage you that not only does the boiling water of life change us, it also reveals what's inside of us, right? So instead of being an egg or a potato, today let's imagine that your heart is like a tea bag. You know, when you look at a tea bag, they're just pretty plain and they all look pretty much the same. But when they're put into hot water, that's when you find out what's inside of that tea bag, right? Is the tea going to be bitter and harsh? Or is it, fragrant and enjoyable and whatever your favorite flavor is, sweet or spicy, whatever you like, but do good things come out? And the same way is true of our hearts. When life gets hot, when things press in, what we've put inside is what's going to come out. So Joseph has allowed God's grace to permeate his heart and life. He's been obedient and submissive to the word of God. And so when he's in this hot water situation here, what's come out now is grace that's flowing out to those around him. And so let's move on now to our third lesson, and that is that God is faithful to bring conviction to the hearts of others. And our responsibility then is to keep our hearts right and to trust him. So God's responsibility is to bring conviction. Our responsibility is our own hearts. We want to keep our hearts right and trust that God is going to work. So we're going to move on into the end of chapter 42 with this lesson number 3. Now, up until this point, we have seen that Joseph has been gracious to his brothers. We've seen him voice his desire to live under God's authority. But now in these last several verses, we are going to really focus on his brothers and how they are going to respond to what's been going on. And we're going to see that God is going to start to work in their hearts as well. So we've been focusing on God's work in Joseph's life. Now we're transitioning to focusing on what God is doing in the hearts of his brothers. Rather than seeing this as an opportunity to bring justice on his brothers for what they had done to him, you know, we've said that Joseph has seen God is working. God is at work, and he has decided to, you know, be a part of that plan. Last week in our homework, we started with a quote that said, God is always doing 10,000 things in your life, and you may be aware of 3 of them. Remember that? You know, God is at work. He's doing many things that we don't see. But here's the deal. When God does show you what he's doing, we have a choice to make. You have to decide, am I going to hold on to what I like, to what I want to do, to my place of comfort or my feelings of, you know, righteousness over this situation? Or when I see God at work, am I going to join him? Am I going to divert my plan to God's plan? Am I going to be a part of what he is doing? And in Joseph's case, you know, that's the choice he made. He remembered his dreams. Now, we don't really know what he might have thought as his brothers came before him, but we know that he, as he had done at every step of his life, he chose to be a part of what God wanted to do in the lives of his brothers and his family, and even more in the future nation that was to come from them. So in these next verses, we're going to see how this conviction is going to grow in the hearts of his brothers, and in the chapters to come, the truth is going to be revealed, and we're really setting up for this big family reunion that's going to happen in the future. So, Joseph has just given his brothers this option of proving that they are honest. He says, 9 of you will go back back to Canaan, and 1 of you will stay here as my prisoner, and you're going to get Benjamin, and you're going to bring him back here to me. So let's now pick up in verse 21. of chapter 42, and we're going to see what his brothers say to this in verses 21 through 23. Then they, the brothers, said to one another, "In truth, we are guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us and we didn't listen. That is why all of this distress has come upon us." And Reuben answered them, "Did I not tell you," remember this is the older brother, "did I not tell you not to sin against that boy? But you didn't listen, and so now there comes a reckoning for his blood." So notice here, it's interesting to me that immediately his brothers jump from their current situation to what they had done almost 20 years ago. And that tells us that they had probably been feeling pretty guilty about their sin for a really long time. You know, when we do wrong, when we sin against God, you know, oftentimes we feel guilty. We know that we're wrong and we've done wrong before God. I mean, these brothers had a lot of guilt in their hearts for what they'd done to Joseph. For sure, but if you were to study their stories, there's a whole lot of guilt going on there. And so God is beginning to work in their hearts. As you go on in the next verses, you see that Joseph gave them the grain they came for. He gave them supplies for their journey, so kind of just pouring on, right? And then he also gave everyone the money that they had paid him. He had it secretly put back into all of their sacks of grain. So they loaded up all this grain and all these supplies, didn't know they were also loading up all the money that they had thought they paid, and they went back to Canaan. Along the way, they opened up one of the bags to take out some grain, and they saw some of this money, and it really freaked them out, and they're like, "What is God doing?" And they say, as a matter of fact, "What has God done to us?" So they were super freaked out. They got home finally. They told Jacob everything that had happened to them. They dumped out all their grain, and now they discover not only did they have one of their portions of money, they have all the money they paid and all this grain. And in verse 35, it just says, they were afraid. And so this is where we're going to kind of leave the brothers. And we have seen that there's been a progression of conviction happening here, right? So they've recognized their guilt. This means that they took responsibility for their actions. They said, okay, we did it. And then in verse, as we move on, not only do they recognize that they're guilty, they call it sin. They know what they did and it was wrong. They said, "We saw his distress of soul. We heard him begging. We didn't listen." And then on the third part of guilt, a healthy guilt, recognizes that there's consequences. So when we sin, we know that there's a consequence or that there's something going to happen as a result of our sin. And so that's kind of this progression of guilt, that we take responsibility for what we did, we call it sin, we say what we did, and we recognize that there are consequences to sin, and that's what we see them moving through. In this chapter, as we close out, really that's where we leave these brothers, with this distress of soul, this unfinished guilt. And we don't want to leave us there today, because that's not God's plan for us, to stay in a place of guilt. And so let's talk a little bit about how God wants us to deal with guilt. And we know that God is faithful to his promises. He will keep working in this family in the chapters to come. But for us, what do we do when we feel guilty? How do we handle guilt in a healthy way? Well, first of all, I think recognize what we do naturally with guilt, which is not productive. I think a lot of times, humanly speaking, we like to rationalize our guilt away. When we know that we have done wrong and that we are sinful, the first thing sometimes that people naturally do is make an excuse for it or deal with it in your mind, right? You're like, "Oh, it wasn't that big of a deal. Nobody's perfect. He deserved it. I need to stick up for myself." So we try to rationalize that what I did wasn't that big of a deal. Sometimes we deal with our guilt by our actions, where we get really busy and we just try not to think about it, or we're talking and we're on social media, or in some cases even resorting to substance abuse like alcohol or something like that to help us cover up what's going on in our hearts. So that's definitely not productive either. We need to take the opportunity to be still and let the Spirit of God work rather than being busy and trying to cover up guilt in that way. And a third way we kind of deal with guilt a lot of times is through what I would just call like spiritual activity. You know, sometimes, and I think the word that Pastor Tim uses is muscling it, where we try to remove the guilt of our own sin with our own actions, and where we are doing spiritual things to cover up the guilt that we feel, rather than doing spiritual things as an act of worship to God, as a gratefulness to all he's done for us. But the healthy response to guilt is to accept responsibility for what we've done, name it as sin, and recognize that there is a consequence, right? When we have sinned against God, there is a consequence before God, and we deserve punishment. But the beauty is that our God is gracious. He has a grace-filled answer for guilt, and it's very simple. First off, 1 John 1:9 tells us, if you confess your sin, He's faithful and just to forgive you your sin. So when you recognize that you've done wrong, he wants us to come to him and to confess it. He wants to forgive us. He wants to not hold us accountable for our sins. Or I guess the better way would say, he doesn't want to deal with us according to our sins, as we learned earlier. He wants to forgive us. And then also we can recognize that he has given us grace to cover that. In Ephesians 2, it says, by grace we're saved through faith. It's a gift of God, not of works. So God's faithful, gracious gift to us was Jesus Christ, who took that punishment. So yes, there's consequences when we sin, but Jesus Christ took those consequences, and by grace, we can have our guilt removed. So receiving grace from God in this way is really the first step to being filled with grace. You know, we want the tea bag of our heart to be filled with beautiful, fragrant, gracious things. And that comes as we, first of all, allow God to remove the guilt that we have for our own sins, and then continue to live recognizing all that he's done, that he's faithfully providing us. So not only forgiving our sins, removing our guilt, but giving us everything we need for life. And then as we live in that place, we can be maybe a little more like Joseph and graciously live out what God is doing and changing inside of our hearts, really in every season of life, no matter where he brings us to.